Welcome to Thriveology Lab Podcast, where we explore the science, philosophy, and practice of thriving. Our goal is to help you create a happier and healthier life through education, application, and transformation. Your co-hosts on this journey are Phil Dunwoody, that's me.
And Neil Lutterbach, that's me. Phil and I are both on the faculty at Juniata College, where we teach courses to promote human thriving and well-being. Today's topic is outside and why spending time outside is good for our health. We'll talk about like why some of these names that we're calling things in particular ways we're calling them will add up when we get to sort of the whole model, but outside, generally nature today. And today in this podcast, we're going to look at Phil and I are going to talk about our relationship to nature and why we believe it should be included in our model of thriving. We'll talk about some of the subtle differences maybe between green and blue spaces. We'll talk about awe and its effects on perceptions of time. And then we'll look at some of the scientific evidence on why you should spend more time outside, as well as some of the sort of humanistic evidence as well.
Yeah, and just quick, like on some of the science, this was another episode for me where I knew a little bit about the research, and as I dove in to really explore it for this episode, it was another one where I was just blown away of actually how much not just correlational evidence there is on the science side, but actual experimental, clinical, randomized clinical control trials, which are kind of the gold standard for saying actually time in nature has really profound effects on your well-being, and it's causal, right? So just a quick we're going to hit some of these through the episode, but a quick list of what the research shows. Research shows that spending more time outside reduces stress and anxiety, improves mood, enhances attention and concentration, boosts creativity and problem solving, lowers the risk of mental illness, improves cardiovascular health and immune system function. That's not because you're exercising, by the way. Right. That's literally just being outside, and promotes better sleep. That's an amazing,
that's an incredible list. That's everything. That's everything. That's like that's like a good life.
You and I know are both outdoor people in that we really love spending time outside. And if I like, I've go ahead.
Well, I was just saying, like, we both do. I think what we talked about this often, but we even talked about it yesterday. Like, I think you are much more sort of flexible, adaptive. You're sort of nature agnostic. Like you love all. Like, what is your relationship to nature? How did you find that was important to you?
So I just briefly, like, I grew up in South Jersey. People think of New Jersey and they think of the megalopolis area between New York and Philly, which is all, you know, built up and. One of the things New Jersey is known for is having more toxic waste sites than any other state in the nation, despite our small size. This was not my experience in South Jersey. Jersey is also, it's called the Garden State. There's actually a lot of farm exports, blueberries. So I actually grew up in the Pine Barrens in a very rural area. My street was a dead end street that, you know, turned into a dirt road. You know, and I was just a little bit up for that. We had very few neighbors. So I grew up spending hours and hours outside. You know, we didn't have cable, didn't run down our street. You know, we could pick up a couple fuzzy channels on the TV. I grew up riding horses, did like some like 25 mile competitive trail ride. So I spent hours on trails outside growing up all the time. Now, also South Jersey, I grew up about a half hour from the shore. So kind of both spending time in the woods and spending time near the ocean were normal for me. And then I remember going into grad school and still loved the outdoors, loved camping. And coming out of grad school, I was actually offered a postdoc with to help run an fMRI that University of Georgia had just helped develop with a local hospital. And, you know, I turned the job down because it meant 40 plus hours a week in rooms with no windows. And I know the guy thought I was crazy when I told him I couldn't, you know, because I asked, well, can I log in from another room? You know, and he's like, well, no, because it's a mainframe, but there wasn't an option for that. And I just said, look, you know, one of the things I've learned about myself through graduate school is I can feel very happy when I enter the building at 8 or 9 a.m., and then I leave at 5 or 6 after spending all day in a fluorescent cubicle with no windows, and I'm depressed. it had a noticeable effect on my well-being then. And so now, today, my go-to when I feel depressed, when I feel stressed, is outside. Even just, you know, we've talked, we're both dog lovers, right? Taking my dogs on a walk. Mm-hmm. It gets me outside, the wind in my hair. I walk to work most days. I feel like I need that for my mental health. And to your point, like, I'll go, if it's snowing and cold, I'll bust out the snowshoes. Mm-hmm. If it's warm and sunny, you know, I'm happy with that. I enjoy the ocean. I enjoy the forests. And so, yeah, it's, you know, it's part of the course that you and I teach, right? We spend a week outside Costa Rica. And that's deliberate. And it really does have a profound effect on kind of our sense of calmness and peace.
Well, and we talked even just yesterday, like we see a noticeable change in our students' behavior, their attitudes, just how they move.
Yeah.
It usually takes like a day or two to sort of acclimate to that sort of temporal change, environmental change, but they just, all of them almost en masse, just become chiller people Wednesday. Everything settles in. And I don't think that's just like, you know, being at a surf camp. There's something else going on. And I would point to that, the amount of time we spend outdoors
And that's what we're going to talk about in this research, right? That space in Costa Rica in particular, it's warm, it's outside, it's near the ocean. That seems to be your happy place, right? Your relationship with nature?
It's weird because like I grew up in a small farm town in northern Indiana. So, you know, very harsh winters. But the town I grew up in was on two lakes, Lake Freeman, Lake Schaefer. And there was a large sort of wooded ravine area behind our house. And the neighborhood kids and I, we spent all the time we could as kids out in that ravine. And that's where that was my imagination place. Mm-hmm. Like I created full worlds, and it was largely that experience that led me then into theater, because all the time I was out there, we were playing Star Wars and superheroes, and like we created these full worlds. And we'll talk about like it wasn't just that like we had downtime that we were playing. I think it was in that space that creativity was sparked, that it was sort of it was a little removed from the world, through all sorts of effects. And as we moved into high school, everybody worked. There was a small amusement park, Indiana Beach, around Lake Schaefer, and like that's where you worked as a high school student. So we were always around outside and around the water. That's outside. So I was always outside. We'll talk about like how things have changed for particularly young people now, and how that may be contributing to some of the mental health concerns we're seeing. But every winter, my family would go to Florida, and we'd go to the Sarasota, Bradenton area, which is where my grandparents were at. And it was always, I don't know if that sparked it, but it was always associated with family and ease. There was a simplicity about it. And so, my default is sun, salt, and saltwater, sand, and sun. Like my three S's. Like I just, closer to the equator, the better. I can't be hot enough. And when things get gray, I get gray.
And of course, you're not the only one. Seasonal affective disorder is a real thing. Like a lot of people find, you know, you and I are here in central Pennsylvania, where it is incredibly gray in the winter. The mountains just kind of, the mountains seem to grab the air and condensation, and we have a lot of cloud cover.
And we'll talk about some of the evidence. Like it doesn't matter. Being outside, period, is good, even if that's not necessarily your jam. But I think there are individual differences. And the more you can get to a place that feels right, like I know when we're in Costa Rica, I just feel like I can breathe. My body has a visceral reaction to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so this is I think one of the things the research shows is that even if you don't enjoy going outside, you still benefit from it, right? So if you go outside and it's cold and you're like, I hate the cold, you actually still show the health benefits associated with being outside. But I think to your point, on your own, you're less likely to go outside if mm-hmm. that's not your right, if that's not your preferred environment. And then the other thing I just want to tag on real briefly, because I don't think we cover this in the list of studies we're going to talk about today, but creativity right. is something that comes up. Being outside seems to, it's almost like it relaxes your mental stuckness for particular things. And we do see that, again, randomly assigning people to spend time inside or outside and then giving them measures of creativity and problem solving, time spent outside, you're actually better. You literally are more creative and you're better at problem solving because you seem to be more flexible in your thinking. And that's yeah. one of the things that being outside seems to do. It seems to promote flexible thinking.
Well, and we'll talk about some of the sort of sensory aspects of that, but it's not a mistake, I think, that artist colonies, writers' mm-hmm. retreats are always by the water, out in the woods, in nature. Like they're not, nobody goes, well, it's not nobody, but you know, you don't go to New York City to do a writer's retreat. You go away yeah. from New York City.
And even meditative communities, right, religious right. communities, right. right? So you look in China and where were the Taoist temples built and the Buddhist temples? Right? You have these pictures of, you know, misty covered mountaintops with temples on them because you, and we're going to talk about awe, you get a place like that and it feels spiritual, right? Mm-hmm. You have this sense of vastness and beauty that is just moving. And so, yeah, like I've spent a lot of time out in Northern California at my Tai Chi teacher, his essentially retreat. And you do meditation and you do Tai Chi and martial arts and you sleep, you eat, sleep, train, repeat. You know, and that's every day. And it's, yeah, it's wonderful.
Well, and we've talked about this in at least one other podcast, like triangulating some of these factors from like an ancestral perspective, like yes. what did our ancestors do? What does the science tell us, right? And what do I sort of naturally gravitate to, this sort of triangulating effect? And like looking at, you know, exactly that, where are these temples being built? Where are people naturally gravitating to? And then looking at some of the science to say, like, why might that be?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That leads us to this biophilia right, idea, yep. right? So tell us about biophilia.
Yeah, so biophilia is coined by psychoanalyst Eric Fromm and later by biologist and naturalist E.O. Wilson in his book, his 1984 book, Biophilia. It's a prevailing theory that we crave connectedness to nature because those are the environments in which we evolved. There are other competing theories of why, but for Phil and I think all of the other theories, tangential theories, all kind of feed back into this larger biophilic theory that as Paleolithic hunter-gatherers, we were always deeply connected to nature, and whether that's islands, island life, or wooded areas, migratory patterns that we went through.
And biologists will say sometimes that nothing makes sense in the absence of evolution.
Right.
And as a psychologist, I actually take that same view, that if you want to understand any aspect of human behavior, one of the things that will help you understand it is to think about what that behavior is. What was the context in which it evolved, right? And how is it kind of functional in an evolved context? And sometimes what we see in terms of problematic behavior or even problems in decision-making are because our current environments are so radically different from the ones that our systems actually evolved to function in. Mm-hmm. And not to romanticize, you know, this kind of wild right. evolutionary past, but to say that that disconnect matters, right? We have, we are evolved animals for particular environments. And we are now just relatively recently spending almost all of our time in very, very different environments that we have engineered, and we haven't engineered them to replicate nature.
Right. Right. And just to talk about how sort of pervasive this biophilia is as a theory, there's a 2022 meta-analysis that looked over 49 studies, a total of over 3,000 participants in those studies. And across the board, they're finding that exposure to natural environments had a medium to large effect on both increasing positive effect and decreasing negative effect in all of those domains that Phil listed at the outset of the podcast, right? Right. And so you're not just looking at a couple different studies. This is a substantial sampling of these different kinds of experiences. And some of those things that might be happening as a result of that, as Phil talked, as we've moved into more urban areas, we've moved farther and farther away, but also the technology has changed. So we talked in the nutrition about how technology has changed our food system. Technology is changing our sleep and circadian patterns, mm-hmm. and it's changing our relationship to nature. And like, as we talked about, you know, in our childhood, and I don't want to sound like the guy's like, when I was a kid, we used to, but, you know, when
it's
I,
true though.
But it's true it's though, true. Right? And you talk about, you know, how much time do young people spend outdoors? It's incredibly less than we did. And even in terms of like people's living experiences, we have over 265 million people live in the U.S. in urban areas. That's 80% of the U.S. population. And that's a 9% increase over since 2010. That's a substantial shift.
It is. It is. And so it's really this combined effect of kind of migration, right? Mm-hmm. Moving from rural to urban spaces, plus the impact of technology, and not just screens, but even things like air conditioning.
Right.
You know, first you had radio, then you had, you know, television, air conditioning, and now with, of course, smart phones and, you know, the lure of technology, we're much more sedentary and we're much, 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 much less likely to spend time outside. To the, you know, growing up, like I spent time outside, there was nothing else to do, right? So my options were pretty limited.
Well,
so
you list those technologies, like even the light, like,
yep.
Like that changed our relationship because you had to rely on candles, which aren't a great source of light, and principally the sun. So you were up with the sun, you went down mm-hmm. with the sun. Now with electronic lights, you can adjust that gas light to electronic light. You can adjust it. You can control your circadian rhythm, which, as when we'll get to the sleep section, isn't a great thing.
Yeah, yeah, right. Which, because we're unintentionally essentially inhibiting the production of melatonin, right? Which is what kind of triggers that sleep cycle. So back to this, like we have these evolved environments and we should expect then large changes from that might lead to essentially suboptimal performance or maybe something less than thriving. And so again, this is part of our overall model, is to ask kind of how current context is different from evolved context, and how we might deliberately then kind of, you know, re-engineer, some people say rewilding, these evolved contexts to then promote better health, really to promote thriving. So, and this is where you do get a lot of research around green spaces, right? So they differentiate between green and blue spaces. We're going to talk about blue spaces in a minute. That's talking about water, essentially. Green spaces are what it sounds like, forest areas. Really having a lot of trees in your urban environment makes that space more green. So it's not a binary, right? You can talk about the amount of green. Let's see, a 2020 study, researchers implemented a 9-week nature intervention at a local YMCA. Each week, participants engage in full-day activities outdoors, including gardening, hiking, and conversation. The authors concluded, quote, analysis of the intervention's evidence that the intervention helped to build social relationships, develop skills, and feelings of self-worth. There were also clear benefits to emotional well-being, with feelings of calm and a reduction in stress. This was published in Humanistic Psychology in 2020. There is now, I'll say, a lot of correlational evidence, large-scale epidemiological studies showing that the closer you live to green spaces, even things like the number of trees on your street and in your neighborhood, have very positive impacts on your both physical health and mental health. And you might surprise, like, well, maybe that's because living near those spaces, you know, wealthier people are more likely to afford properties there. That's true, but these correlations hold up even when you control for income statistically. We still see them. And it's not just proximity, but there's also then research that more time spent in nature, so the amount of time you spend. So the 2019 paper published in the journal Nature really found 120 minutes a week is kind of this break point. Those who spent more than that, so you're talking 2 hours, had self-reported better health and well-being scores than those less than 120 minutes. And additional time above that 120 minutes saw additional benefits, with a cap of somewhere in the 200 to 300 minutes a week. Beyond that, it didn't seem like more time outside made much of a difference. All of those things are either qualitative or correlational and are not causal evidence. In other words, you know, is it you have chicken and egg things going on there, right? So what's the causal direction? You do have now kind of an explosion of research looking at this experimentally. And this is relatively new. I think, you know, to some extent, you go back in time and people say like, that's a bunch of new age hooey, right? We're not going to research that. Actually, now there's pretty good hard science. And some of this comes out of Japan and is in part a reaction to Japanese culture of high pressure work environment. So in the 1980s in Japan, this term was coined karoshi, and it literally translates to death by overworking, right? So there's such this great pressure to please the organization, your boss, especially for young workers who felt they had to work all the time, who were, you know, essentially not sleeping enough, not seeing their families. There was this growing issue of people literally dying at their desk from exhaustion. That's amazing.
It's astonishing.
Yeah, it is. And so the Japanese government has tried to put regulations in place to limit paid overtime. I mean, there was one study showing that one in four companies had employees working at least 20 hours of overtime per week. That's on top of your 40-ish hour work week. Another thing that came out is the Japanese government started looking at what's called forest bathing, right? So forest bathing is this Shinrin Yoku. I'm sure I don't have the pronunciation exactly right, but approximately, is spending time in a forest. And they don't mean literally like you're not taking a bath in the forest. I'm going to read a quote here from this is a book, Forest Bathing, published in 2018 by Dr. Jing Li. And he's one of the kind of leading experts on this topic. Shinrin is Japanese, in Japanese means forest, and yoku means bath. So Shinrin Yoku means bathing in the forest atmosphere or taking in the forest through our senses. This is not exercise or hiking or jogging. It is simply being in nature, connecting with it through our sense of sight, hearing, taste, smell, and touch. So this should sound very familiar, right? You and I both talk a lot about mindfulness, and when we've done two episodes now on mindfulness, we teach about it. This is a mindfulness practice. Right. It's kind of about that resting and open awareness as you walk through a nature trail. You're not on your headphones. Again, this is not vigorous exercise. This is actually paying attention, noticing through your senses.
Well, and I think there's several things that pop out at me as you're talking about all of this. And one that you know, We've engineered a life that we are having to sort of re-engineer back to some other things. And so I think what we're also asking of ourselves, Phil and I, in our own lives, is like questioning what are the assumptions culturally we're making about work, about like some of these things, and is that the right path I want to be on? And, you know, we often say that, you know, well-being or thriving really needs to be a person's priority, and then everything else gets built on top of that. And so often culturally, even in the United States, we tend to think of those things as an after effect. And we hear that even reflected in our students, our college students, like, I'll take care of I'll sleep, I'll eat well, I'll exercise when I've done all the other work I need to do.
Yeah.
And what if we flip that model? And I think the other thing, and part of that is also this divorce of our sensory experience. We tend to sort of think of ourselves as these kinds of machines that just do a thing, almost robots, that don't have these sensory experiences, smell, taste, that isn't part of our cognitive, emotional experience. And it very much is. We've just engineered it out of our lives.
Yeah, and exactly. And this forest bathing research does talk specifically about that when you're engaged in nature, it is a fully immersive experience, engaging all of your senses in the way that when I'm working on the computer, it's my visual senses really that I'm activating to do that work more than anything else.
And there's also that, and you talk about this better than I do, but like when I'm engaged in like a task, it's very focused attention, and I'm having to keep that focused attention for a very long time. And being out in nature allows that focus to diffuse and sort of soften.
Yeah, and they do talk about that soft focus, and even perceptual fluency is one of the words they use, one of the terms. And some of it has to do with watching things in nature, listening. It's engaging without being demanding. And we all know that when you sit around a campfire, you can't not look at the campfire, right? When you're sitting on the beach, you can't not look at the waves and listen to the waves. It just, it pulls your attention, but it does it in a way that is soothing and relaxing. So let's talk about one of the studies that uses random assignment. There are a lot of these. We're not going to cover a bunch of these, but to mention one of them. So several publications now have used random assignment. Dr. Jingli has done a lot of this research, other people as well. There's research out of South Korea. There's research out of the United States looking at these. And in general, what it shows is, you know, being in nature lowers blood pressure and has this kind of clear immune system boost. So some of Dr. Lee's work, well, a lot of it actually focuses on natural killer cells, NK cells. So natural killer cells are a type of lymphocyte. It's a white blood cell, crucial to the body's immune system. Unlike other immune cells, such as T cells or B cells, which require prior exposure to a specific pathogen, NK cells can recognize and eliminate infection or cancer cells without prior exposure, right? So having a high level of these in our background essentially helps with metabolism in that it identifies problematic cells, precancerous cells, and helps with the cleaning and flushing process. And more time spent in nature. Again, this is random assignment. You randomly assign people to walk down a nature trail or stay in an urban environment. And then they do kind of often like blood, urine, sometimes saliva samples. And they see this, one of the things that shows up is this boost in NK cells, right? So it's this immune system body health response that you see noticeably impacted, at the same time, a pretty dramatic decrease in blood pressure. I mean, drops in blood pressure that are more than we tend to see with medication, which is phenomenal. So, and one of the questions is, how long do these things last, right? And so that's where you get these kind of recommendations on at least 2 hours a week in nature. 3 to 4 is actually better. And you might be peaking out in terms of some of these measurable effects. But I'll say, not only is this fascinating to me, it gets even better, because one of the things that Dr. Lee did, this kind of blew my mind, was he randomly assigned people to stay in hotels, right, for 3 nights. And the random assignment was 2 different conditions. One group had cypress tree oil in their vaporizers, and the other group didn't. And the presence of that cypress tree oil was enough to cause a measurable increase in this NK cell production, these natural killer cells. I spend a lot of time outside anyway, but I could do that easily at home, right? I mean, and why not if there's a health benefit? That just blows my mind.
Yeah. Well, we see that across a lot of different studies that, like, even like the sight of something or the smell of something or the sound of something. You were saying even before we started that you were listening to nature sounds.
When I get stressed, I play. It's my Spotify list is nature's forest sounds.
And I start every single morning just watching surfing videos. I just have the ocean on constant play. And so, you know, even, you know, and it feels pleasurable. It feels like I just feel better having, even though it's not the real thing, there's something about it that our bodies, from a sensory perspective, just gravitate to.
Yeah, and so this shifts us, I think, from green spaces to blue spaces. Right.
Right? Well, and I think all of the things that Phil was talking about in the green spaces show up in blue spaces as well. But I, you know, again, some of it is sort of where you find yourself gravitationally pulled, where you individually feel. For me, it's definitely blue spaces, and even particularly blue spaces, that ocean water, the smell of salt water does something for me. But as in my other life, I'm also a playwright, and I'm very concerned about like words and like where words, and thinking about like how water and water imagery pops up in all kinds of aspects in our life. You think about religious ceremonies, baptisms are in water. In Taoism, there's a quote from Lao Tzu, water's motion is the flux of the Tao, which essentially just means the way. Its highest good is like water. It comes closest to the way. That water is the Tao. It is the way, or it comes closest to being that because of its fluid nature. And we think about the transitional nature of water. It's this mutable force that's easy, but also shapes continents. It changes mm-hmm. forms, and it's ripe for sort of metaphor for us as people. So thinking about how we even talk about things in our life, we talk about going with what? The flow. Where does that flow come from? Or we talk about capital F flow, like Csikszentmihalyi's flow, which we'll talk about in a later episode, I'm sure. That's all water imagery, right?
Bruce Lee says, be like water.
Be like water, right, yeah. And so one of the other things, you know, that this is certainly true in green spaces as well, but something Phil and I have talked about in the past is also, what is also curious about water is while we evolved sort of to come out of the water, we didn't evolve to go back into it, right? So we don't have gills, we don't have flippers, and we can relatively quickly die just by being in the water and not being conscious of our oxygen level, right? So there's something about that that also teaches us humility. And we'll talk about humility as a larger concept in nature when we get to things like awe. But here's a quote from surfer Greg Long. And this comes out of Walsh J. Nichols' book, Blue Mind. I highly recommend this text. It's sort of the just a masterful tone. But Greg Long says, you're just caught up in those few seconds and nothing else matters, talking about surfing. Sound, smell, everything just totally goes out the window. It's what's directly in front of you, and what you need to do is make that wave and nothing else. You're dealing with the energies that are so much greater than you or anything you've ever dealt with. And that's that sensory aspect. Mm-hmm. It's a partnership with this force of nature, of the world that you can't control. You are in many ways out of control. And the only way, and this goes, you know, Phil and I teach this course, I'm focused on surfing, Phil's focused on Tai Chi, and we share mindfulness between it. But we're always finding these connections between things like Tai Chi and surfing. You can't force the thing. You have to learn to dance with that energy. And what a great lesson a teacher nature is for us, that we go out into nature not only to have these positive effects, but to learn something about ourselves
and this
and
is
our world.
Yeah, and this is just to piggyback on that. This is actually one of the fundamental aspects of Taoism as a philosophy is that the answers to all of your questions can be found in nature, right? And so Taoism is very big on spending time in nature, observing nature, essentially learning to be like nature. And Tai Chi is really the attempt to kind of embody Taoist philosophy as both a movement art and a martial art.
And Walsh J. Nichols talks about this in his book, Blue Mind. But, you know, if you think about people's happiest memories, they're almost always in connection with nature, but often around water. They're going to the lake, they're going fishing with their father, they're going learning to swim with their mother, they're whatever it is, it often involves water. And again, that sensory aspect, this comes from Shelley Batts, a Harvard Medical School senior research fellow who specializes in the effects of sound. And this goes back to that sensory thing we were talking about. And Batts put subjects in an fMRI and showed them either traffic or waves crashing on the beach. And the sound is often the same, right? The roar of traffic, the roar of waves crashing has a kind of continuous roar about it. And yet what they found is that the sound of the waves produced a different response in the medial prefrontal cortex and the auditory cortex. And so the medial prefrontal cortex is largely responsible for linking sensory inputs and in our emotional response. It's also that medial prefrontal cortex is also the same brain region responsible for our feelings of compassion and connection. Mm-hmm. So here again, that smell of the oil or the sound of the waves, we are sensory animals, and that has what I think Phil and I would argue an evolutionarily wired reaction. We hear those sounds, something happens. I feel more open. I feel more compassionate.
Yeah, more connected, right?
More connected, right.
Exactly. That's huge. That shows up in the awe literature as well.
And just I know we're getting into some our time here, but I want to call out one other thing. Like we, Phil and I both love science, parts of our lives, certainly more so Phil's part of our lives is science at the very least. But it's important also to remember that, that science is only one way to know things, that art, the humanities are also another way that are just as valid ways of knowing things. And so I just want to point out to, and I don't think Phil, you and I have had a chance to talk about this. I've gotten into sailing, like watching sailing videos. Anyway, blah, blah, blah. There's a fantastic documentary. It's a 2021 documentary called Hell or High Seas.
Yep.
And it follows U.S. Navy veteran Taylor Grieger and his best friend, a writer, Stephen O'Shea. Grieger gets out of the Navy and he was a pararescue, like jumping out of helicopters into the ocean to save people. And most of the people they go looking for have gone. They're gone. They're dead. And so he developed PTSD. And so he decides to get a sailboat, and he and his best friend, and they also get a couple other friends, to sail from Florida down to Cape Horn at the bottom of South America, which is notoriously some of the roughest waters on the planet. And it's like, you know, this like ramshackle, like they're taping up things. It's falling apart. It's harrowing. But you watch them wrestle with this, the nature, the power of the water, and how healing that was, how much camaraderie, sense of community and brotherhood they experience on this trip, how connected they are, how alive they are. And he expertly cut, like they'll have conversations like, we're probably going to die tonight, this is the end. And then the next cut's like they're screaming with joy, like this ecstatic experience. So I think this is a powerful reminder of how nature just, you hear this time and time again from surfers to rock climbers to people out in the world, how much more they feel alive. And I think that anecdotal evidence is powerful as much as the fMRIs and all the other science. I think that also just how people report themselves feeling.
And what's most compelling is when we find convergence in those
moments, mm-hmm, right?
So you have these, you know, kind of personal stories and experiences and you can relate to that. People actually relate much better to that than they do to statistical right research. They find it more convincing very often. But then when you also then kind of see that, okay, yeah, the hard science backs these things up. For me, that's the most convincing, is when you have this kind of this convergence.
Yeah. So why don't we move on, Phil, and talk about like another aspect of nature, not exclusively nature, that can impact our well-being here.
When you ask people about experiences in nature, awe is one of these terms that comes up, and this feeling of awe has actually gotten a good bit of research, right? So Shuoda is one of the authors who's done a lot of research on this. And in one of their studies, this is 2007, they asked people to kind of recall a time when some nature scene was really beautiful. And the response is people often reported feelings of something, the presence of something greater than themselves, a sense of being small and insignificant, not wanting the experience to end. And so kind of these self-reports really refer to often two different things, perception of vastness, right, as well as a need for accommodation. So if we talk about those a little bit, the sense of vastness, not only do I feel small, my problems feel small. Mm-hmm. So something that was really stressing me out, I look out and, you know, when I get to a big outlook, you know, on a trail and I'm looking out over mountains and valleys, all of my problems just feel less important. You know, they feel less urgent than they did before. And some of this accommodation refers to, accommodation is a cognitive concept, comes from Piaget. And it's this idea that we come into contact with some new idea or thing that doesn't fit well with our existing structures, our existing mental structures. And so we have to accommodate that, right? And so I might be stuck in, you know, hyper-focused on my job, and I might be stressed out because of all the problems. And then I go and I spend some time in Costa Rica at the beach and time in nature, and I get this sense of awe, this vastness, And part of the accommodation then is this, what I'm feeling in terms of this spiritual sense, this connectedness with things, doesn't fit with kind of the hyper-focused, compartmentalized world I've been living in. Mm-hmm. So I have to rethink my relationship with my work and nature. And so it seems to be those two factors. And people do differentiate between positive awe and negative awe, right? Because negative awe can be a vastness of something that, you know, if you're in the middle of an avalanche,
right,
you're going to have the experience of awe, but that is all going to be terrifying, right? So we're mainly here talking about the positive aspects of awe, which is something different.
Yeah, I think, like, I remember a distinct moment of being in Hawaii, sort of away from light pollution, and seeing the stars and seeing how full the sky was with stars. And I hadn't seen anything quite like that. And it was, you know, in art, we often talk about kinetic art and static art. And kinetic art makes you want to do something. So ads are kinetic. They make you want to go buy something, make you want to go eat something. Static art arrests you in your place. So the Mona Lisa stops you in your tracks. And I remember looking up at the sky and seeing the just the profundity of stars in the sky and stopping dead in the street and just realizing how small I was. And we were all just spinning around on this rock in this space. And that was awe.
That's a great example. I had a number of years ago, my dad and my two boys and I went to Yellowstone, and we went out late one night and laid at the edge of a lake so we could just look up and see the star, because it was clearer than any place certainly my boys had been. And it wasn't long. You know, we talked about it takes 20 minutes for your eyes to fully dark adapt. So you have to stay in that environment for 20 minutes without looking at, without a flashlight, without your phone, in order to have your eyes kind of fully perceive all the stars and everything. And after we're laying there for a bit, my one son turned to me and says, like, he said, "Is that the Milky Way?" You know, and it was this experience of awe. Like, he had heard the term.
Right.
But to see it, it's powerful. Yeah. It's emotionally, right? Yeah, it arrests you, to your point.
So one of the things that also the effect of awe also changes our perception of time. So as Phil mentioned, like, people say they're not wanting that experience to end, but you often hear people talk about sort of this elastic nature of time in those environments where time and the self sort of disappear. I don't have a sense of sort of the confines of my own body sometimes. You'll hear surfers talk a lot about, particularly as people going into barrels and tubes, they'll say, like, time actually stops. That feeling of time has just stopped in its tracks. But you often feel that not only do I not want it to end, it has this fluidity about it that doesn't have the sort of day-to-day confines of our experiences of time in normal life.
Yeah. And so, just because we are about at time, why don't we just real quick, I want to mention just some of the research that we did not cover as brief highlights. So Bratman et al. 2015 study showing that nature experiences reduce rumination. All these ones I'm listing now are actually randomized controlled studies. Berman et al. 2012, participants took either a walk in nature or an urban environment after completing a mentally fatiguing task. Those who walked in nature showed significant improved attention and working memory. So it seems to be this restorative effect of spending time in nature in terms of your cognition. A 2013 study by Rowe et al. Measured cortisol and found that the more time you spend in nature, the lower your cortisol levels are. Cortisol is a stress hormone. It's kind of that fight or flight, right? It's a sign that our stress response is maybe overactivated. Time in nature seems to kind of more engage that parasympathetic, that relaxation. And then just one more, Moretta et al. 2007. This was 498 participants comparing the effects of forest therapy, walking in the forest, this kind of forest bathing, to standard urban walks. And the groups exposed to forest environments showed significant reductions in depression anxiety along with an improved vigor. I haven't mentioned there are plenty of studies showing reductions in blood pressure, increases in creativity and problem solving, I mentioned. So it is a humbling and convincing amount of research. But to your earlier point, this isn't just the research, right? We can look at kind of our traditions, and you have, you know, Thoreau spending time in nature. You have Darwin going on long, long walks as he's, you know, thinking about and kind of refining his theory of evolution. Great, great poets and artists who are spending massive amounts of time in nature, and it is helping them connect with something larger and communicate something larger, making massive contributions, great contributions to their fields. And then you have the religious aesthetic, because that time in nature makes you feel connected with something greater. And some of that, it feels holy, it feels spiritual. So you have this convergence on all these different sides.
And fun, I think, you know, all of that. Like, when we think about stories of adventure, it's not like people going into the city for adventure, right? You're going out into the woods. You're going exploring. You're getting in a canoe. You're going on a ship to sail off into the unknown. And we, as human beings, we are also, I think, natural explorers. And so to the degree that you can explore in your own life, you know, nature is where that can be found.
Yeah. And I think just to flip the narrative on some of this, to kind of bookend it with what we talked at the beginning in terms of biophilia, and really we evolved for natural environments. The research, a lot of the research is like, okay, time in nature, you know, it causes reductions in stress and blood pressure and, right, increases NK cells and whatnot. Flipping that is to say that, well, time in nature is actually our default.
Right.
Right. So we would have spent all of our time in nature, right evolutionarily. Right. And so it's actually time outside of nature that is causing dysregulation from what should be, arguably, our body's natural state of health.
Right. And I think that's part of what our model is like getting back in all of these domains to that. So your challenge this week, our friends, get outside more. That can be adding an extra hour to your day, to your week, whatever you can manage. And I was speaking with a colleague the other day who carves out Sunday, no technology whatsoever, outside as much as possible. If you can carve out a full day a week, that's brilliant. We're going to do it too. Like, how can you add even a little bit more time outside and see if you can get really outside? If you not just sort of walk from building to building outside, but get into the woods, get close to water, whatever your particular situation allows. See if you can push that a little
bit. And then to bring that, the focus that there is in forest bathing, kind of regardless of what your natural environment is, allowing your senses to be immersed in it. So you're not in nature on your phone, right? Or listening to your, you know, earbuds rocking out of whatever music, right? But you're actually noticing, kind of letting it wash over you, really bathing in the senses, the sensory experience of being in nature.
So thank you. That is it for this episode. Please subscribe to the Thriveology Lab on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave a comment or question on YouTube, and we will be sure to respond. And be sure to follow us on Instagram and Facebook. We're posting a lot of the research we're talking about. We're posting those articles and some summaries of those, so you can find those articles and find them and read them in more depth if you're interested in them. If you have questions or comments, or there's a subject you'd like to hear us discuss, please reach out to thriveologylab@gmail.com. Thrive on, our friends.
Thrive on.